Distributing the Future, broadcast April 3rd, 2006. Patterns for Communication, Moderation, and Information Processing.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. This week we feature edits of three more presentations from this year's Emerging Technology Conference: George Dyson on von Neumann, Clay Shirky on patterns for moderation, and John Udell looks for ways to assist communication. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Host your next meeting online with GoToMeeting. Everyone logs on to your meeting during your conference call so they see your computer desktop on their computer screen. It's like meeting in person, but less expensive and time-consuming. With GoToMeeting, you can demo products, present, or train just like you're in the same room. GoToMeeting has a low, flat monthly rate, so meet as often as you want for as long as you need. Try it free today at gotomeeting.com/DTF. That's gotomeeting.com/DTF. When you stop to read an email or to catch up on a blog or to click on a URL, you're changing context. That minute you spend away from your work could be very costly. It could take a long time to get your head back in the task at hand. But when you take a moment to glance at emails that you've received in the last hour, it takes no real attention to quickly scan the subject lines and decide which ones need to be read and which can be deleted. It's only when you decide to actually read one of the emails that the true context switching tax is levied. John Udell talks about ways in which we can make it easier on other people to decide whether or not they want to read what we've written before they've had to stop what they're doing and commit to reading it. His first pattern comes out of publishing and is titled Heads, Decks, and Leads. Does your title help a reader know what they'll be getting?
We are all seekers of attention. We all have ideas to promote. We all have projects that we'd like to work with people on. We all have agendas that we'd like to publicize. And so, to that end, we all make claims on other people's attention. How can we reward those claims on other people's attention consistently? So how to communicate effectively, make the best use of other people's time. Writing titles or really naming anything is a hard process. It's psychologically difficult, and I think one of the reasons why is that there is this cognitive dissonance between our subjective sense of what we know and what we're about and how that's perceived by the outside world when we try to project or communicate that. So, you know, we think people can read our minds. Why should we have to externalize, get outside of ourselves and see from the outside in what we're presenting looks like and how it ought to be described? So that's just a hard process. There's a whole industry of search engine optimization and people obsess about getting their result to show up on the Google page, and then, well, what are you presenting the world when you appear there, right? You know, you've got your title, but it's not really saying anything about the piece of content that, with great effort, you made appear on that Google page. The really simple thing to do that I advocate is to structure your doc titles, right? Think of the namespace of your HTML doc titles as a sort of a virtual database of metadata, and put in there the date, the author, the type. You know, is it a news article or a review? Right, that's really meaningful. So, having done that, you get a number of interesting benefits. Right, one of them is that those titles don't just show up that way on your site; they show up that way on any site, including Google. Right, so here you've actually made it easier to focus attention on your stuff for wherever it shows up. You know, why do search engines always just give you sort of the context around the term that you were looking for? If you had someone who thought very carefully about what were the layers of information, you know, the heads and the decks that really were the entry points into that story, why wouldn't you present that in the search results context? Not everybody's a publisher, but we all do a lot of writing, and we all write a lot of email in particular. You know, a huge amount of collaboration goes on in mailing lists. What would it be like if discussion threads had titles that told a story, right? You can actually absorb the entire sense of this discussion without necessarily drilling down and reading every message. Active context is sort of an umbrella term, and here's one of the patterns that's been very powerful for me lately. Someone asks me a question, what do you know about such and such? My answer is a URL, or several URLs. I think of it as an active resource collection. You know, this thing gets out there, and a bunch of effects can happen, right? So I'm sure a lot of people in this room are pretty familiar with all of the stuff that goes on here, but you know, what are the tags that are related to the things in this collection? Who are the other people who have an interest in this? And, you know, through them, what are other topics and what are other resources that are related? There's also a concept of scoping here, which is extremely interesting. So there's sort of right now, there's me and world. You know, we're not yet to the sort of intermediate level of let me see the things that have been bookmarked by my trust circle. Even as recently as maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago, if someone said, you know, what do you know about such and such? My response would be a list, right? I mean, I put a list of things together and send them the list. And now I send them the URL, and the point is that the URL is a promise, right, to refresh itself in the future with additional items that I add to that list. So it's a self-updating kind of thing, which is actually quite magical. So that's a sense in which the collection is active. It's active in the sense of also being queryable, and you know, we've seen a lot of that kind of thing. It's even starting to sink into popular consciousness. I think the idea that that this token that you hand someone is a query, right? And you know, we have a long way to go, I think, in terms of making the formulation of queries easier for people to understand. But I do think the idea is starting to sink in. And then this is a little just digression that is something I've been working on. So my blog uses a number of sort of private microformats. And just a consequence of that is that I can query the entire contents of my blog for the last couple of years for things like quotes by Ward Cunningham or you know, Python code snippets, right? And so, you know, these are resources which are queryable and identifiable at the sub-document level. I got Doug Kay at IT Conversations to put this sound clip technology up. So you can actually bookmark a 1 minute or 1 minute and 30 second piece of some show on IT Conversations, right? These are my sound bites and Delicious that I've bookmarked. This is just a picture of the sky from Jim Gray's Sky Server project. The point being here that what he was talking about was, in his case, spatial joints, right? So in astronomy, you've got a reading from telescope, a reading from another telescope. You know, one's at this resolution, one's at this resolution. How do you know that you're talking about the same thing, right? He has this concept of a spatial join, and I think we need, you know, a similar ability to be able to join all kinds of resources. Storytelling is sort of what we do as a tribe, right? That's you know, our ancient way of capturing the attention of other members of our tribe. This, very quickly, is how I got the URL for the Scott Mays Lisa Dussault interview that I gave to someone who asked me the question, you know, where's the 2 minutes that really talks about what's the benefit of CalDev? Well, I had been on a run listening to the talk, and I was able to retrieve the information by basically remembering, you know, how far I was on my run when I heard this talk, and so I knew that it was about that far into the audio, and that's how I retrieved it. This is
what we did here is about a page of code to do a dynamic table of contents.
It's a screencast with Jason Hunter. After I did the screencast with Jason, I set about learning XQuery, and about a week or two later, I did the usual thing. I opened up 11 windows with documentation and you know, code examples, and started to do the usual procedure, but I was actually searching for something that I didn't know the name of, right, which was a function or a procedure to do something, and I realized I'd seen it. You know, I knew that he had showed it to me, and I was able to retrieve that information by going to the video because I knew where I had seen, where I had been shown the thing that I needed to learn, which to me seemed profound. I mean, you guys have seen how effective this stuff is. I'm sure most people saw the spoof of the packaging of the iPod. You know, if Microsoft had designed the iPod packaging, right? I mean, this stuff isn't just propaganda, right? This is a powerful way to capture attention and communicate messages. And I think that, you know, that we, the people in this room, you know, who are inventing the future of technology as it relates to society, are going to have to find a lot of these kind of better, more effective ways to communicate not just, you know, how this stuff works, but what it's for, and if it isn't evil, you know, how and why it's not evil, and what it's going to do for us, and what it's going to do to improve the quality of our lives. Thank you.
John Udell at this year's ETEC. Clay Shirky thinks that the pattern level is the right level to look at how sites moderate interaction. In a talk titled Shut Up, No, You Shut Up, Shirky compared sites like Slashdot, which have several levels of structure, with a Buffy the Vampire fan site. Shirky has jump-started a pattern language for moderation, which explores the balance between allowing people to contribute to a site without having them be too annoying. He maps the problem for the audience by laying out this set of horizontal and vertical axes.
Imagine a measurement, you could call it communal freedom. And by communal freedom, I mean how much freedom does the software allow for the users to communicate with one another as a group? Right. How much does the software catalyze group communication? And you can imagine a scale from zero to complete. So over in the left-hand edge, you can imagine, say, Notepad. Right? No matter how many users of Notepad there are, it's never going to be catalyzing group conversation among those users. All the way over the right-hand side, you can imagine Usenet. Anyone with an email address or web access can post to Usenet. And Usenet makes very little restriction on user registration or any other kind of preventive or controlling measure. So it's implicitly global and broadly available. And you could put any piece of software along that axis. Now imagine a y-axis. We'll call it annoyingness. How annoying is the community? Right? And by annoyingness, I mean how much is it susceptible to the kinds of social dilemmas that come into group spaces? Flaming, trolling, unfunny cascades, all the other kinds of things that are alluded to in the title of the talk. You'd like to be able to launch applications that have a moderate amount of communal or communicating freedom, that allow the groups to have a moderate-sized conversation with one another, in return for a moderate set of problems. Imagine you were a developer who was facing this kind of problem. You knew you were going to launch an application with social ramifications. You was going to put a group of users in touch with one another, and you wanted to mitigate this, mitigate the annoyingness somehow. And you wanted to learn from what had been done already. If you go out and look at the applications currently running, you're either operating at that very high level of detail, what does the whole application do, or you're operating down at the level of the code. And neither of those are particularly good at helping us figure out social problems. So let me illustrate this using Slashdot. Right. Slashdot sees hundreds of thousands of users a day. Every single site it posts to the homepage is implicitly available for comment by any of those users. And yet, over about 10 years, it's done a remarkably good job of maintaining a kind of homeostasis and not, in fact, being swamped by negative social effects. This is Slashdot in one sentence. This is the gestalt of the Slashdot comment system. There's a small number of users who care to an unusually high degree that Slashdot succeeds. They're logged in, they have high karma, and they moderate the system. And Slashdot gets those users to form a defensive membrane between readers and writers. Every comment is rated on this 7-point scale. +5 is very good, -1 is abysmal. And the members who moderate the system effectively rank all of these posts. Now the average reader, the reader who isn't logged in, or the reader hasn't changed any defaults, never sees posts rated at 0 or -1. Despite the incredibly high visibility, there has been almost no successful attempt to replicate Slashdot. There are a couple of examples of having forked the code base, as with Plastic.com. But in fact, taking the Slashcode software in order to learn from Slashdot has turned out to be a really lousy way to work. So if neither the gestalt of members defending readers from writers, nor the actual code base, is the way to derive any value from looking at Slashdot and trying to learn from it, how can we get at that value? What I'm proposing is to develop a pattern language, and I'll illustrate that starting with the problem. The problem Slashdot faces is the tragedy of the commons. Right? There is a communally held resource, which is effectively the aggregate attention of the users. Everybody has an incentive to see that maintained well for Slashdot to thrive. Each person writing a comment has an incentive to defect in order to get the most attention for themselves. So put in terms of this problem, you can look at the ways that Slashdot tries to solve the tragedy of the comments. The first thing Slashdot does is that they move comments to a separate page. This effectively subdivides the total audience by area of interest, which has the effect of reducing the perimeter they need to defend in the first place. They simply reduce the size of the comments before defending it. It also communicates from the owners of the site that the comments are ancillary to the site itself. And when you see this at the level of a pattern, You can then say, I can ask myself, do I want to have comments on the main page or on a separate page for any place users are talking to each other? And you can start to understand the ramifications of that for site design without having to take the entire Slashdot system as a kind of tied together whole. Similarly, Slashdot, the attitude embodied in Slashdot is that they don't have users. They have readers and writers, and their behaviors are very different. And by making that distinction, Slashdot is able to figure out ways to defend readers from writers. And then there's the rating system, and I won't go through all of the patterns, but the moderation system is then the way that they engage this defensiveness. But since social software is the land of unintended consequences, adding the moderation system creates a new problem. Who will guard the guardians? Once I allow one group of users to pass judgment on another group of users, right, I then have to defend against abuse in those circumstances. So Slashdot has an entire second set of systems which don't solve the tragedy of the commons problem, they solve the who will guard the guardians problem. One of the advantages of working in this way, right, is you can start to make comparisons between seemingly unrelated things. This is Bronze Beta. This is the Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan site. When you go to Bronze Beta, it's quite unlike Slashdot in many ways. In the first instance, at the top left-hand corner of the page are three boxes. Fill in your email address, fill in your login, password optional, only if you want to protect your username, and put any comment you like in that box. And when you hit submit, right, your comment goes into the single central conversational queue and appears at the top. It's essentially the simplest possible group blog. Now, it would be easy to look at this and say, well, this is accidental, right? They simply didn't know what they were doing, and so they wrote, you know, a CGI script circa 1996. The interesting thing about Bronze Beta is it's beta because this is the second version of it. When WP sold Buffy the Vampire Slayer to UPN, and aren't I a big old geek for knowing that, when they sold Buffy the Vampire Slayer to UPN, UPN said, we're going to cancel the bulletin board that we've been supporting. And the users rallied together, and they had a second community made for themselves, and they said to the programmers, don't give it any features. Right? That was an explicit goal of the design of that site. Right? Threading, forking, alerting, user rating, all of those things create a kind of complexity that they decided they didn't want. So instead of regarding it as accidental, we now can, as a pattern, say, don't have features is a specific strategy for reducing complexity. Unlike Slashdot, right, comments are the site here. There's nothing else. Everything else is an external pointer. So you can see, in comparing the difference between Bronze Beta and Slashdot, what happens when the site makes the community central versus making it annotative and ancillary. Neither of those choices is better or worse. But having the design conversation about which choice we want to make is, I think, the crucial opportunity here. That is the public and official and short-term reason why I think a pattern language for moderation strategies is important. It's simply a problem we face as a community, and I think it's a good way to solve it. Here's the longer-term reason that I think that this is important. In 2003, Dave Weiner, and there, I said it, I owe everybody in the audience a beer, Dave Weiner was running a mailing list called Blog Rollers. And Blog Rollers was for the discussion of weblogs and syndication strategies, RSS, XML, and so forth. And one fine day in April, Dave said, I have grown tired of the fractiousness of this list. And as of right now, and unilaterally, I am turning it into a moderated-only list. This was not, how to put this politely, this was not well received by the members of the list, right? And the interesting thing to me about the subsequent conversation is that it wasn't about technology at all, because no one disputed that Dave had the ability to do what he did. What he did was he took the typical happy fun ball of a mailing list where everybody is talking to everybody else, and he transformed it to this in one step, where no one was allowed to talk to anyone without going through Dave. And the conversation around that change was an entirely normative conversation. What should have happened? What affirmative duty, if any, did he have to his users? And this is the second reason, the longer-term reason, the more speculative reason, that I think a pattern language for this stuff matters. Because this is part of a long and ancient and important conversation. To take just two examples, Thomas Hobbes, writing at the dawn of political modernity in The Leviathan, advanced the argument that humans in our native state live lives of such chaos that we need an absolute leader, we need a monarch to impose control. And that without that, our lives will be famously nasty, brutish, and short. And that argument said, if from time to time tyranny happens, it is still better than the alternative, which is chaos. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, writing a little over a century later in The Social Contract, took issue with this and said essentially, no, might does not make right. On top of ability, there is affirmative duty. A leader must support their subjects, and the subjects have the right to agitate against the leader if they are not being well served. And this is the context in which the conversation around social software is moving. You can imagine Hobbes and Rousseau having a conversation around the blog roller's mailing list. I think the Hobbes argument would be essentially, the conversation makes it the software makes it possible to do this, bad things happen from time to time, that's showbiz. I think the Rousseau reply would be that if the software does not make it possible for the users to defend themselves against abuse from the leaders, something needs to change. It is both speculative and grandiose to believe that by describing the world correctly, we can change it. But that's what I believe. We are the experimental wing of political philosophy, which is a discipline that doesn't even know it has an experimental wing. Right? And as group conversation and collaboration increasingly moves to mediated environments, we are literally encoding the bargains around freedom of speech and freedom of expression in our tools. And we need to be having the conversation not just about login systems and so forth, but really about the explicit goals, about what it is we're supporting, and about what it is we're trying to do. Because that conversation matters. We need to get it right for ourselves because we have short-term goals, because we're designing new tools, and because the cliff face of annoyingness comes in very quickly when we enable users to talk to one another. And we have to learn from all of the experiments that have been conducted already in moderating those strategies. But we also need to get this right in the long term because society needs us to get it right. And I think that having the language to talk about this is the place to start. Thank you.
Clay Shirky on his pattern language of moderation strategies from eTech. George Dyson admitted that he'd come to eTech intending to give a talk he'd given before. Once he saw that half of the audience had been to the conference before, he decided to write a new one. Dyson draws lines between separate disciplines in ways that make you think differently about things you thought you understood. He looks at the history of computing and focuses on von Neumann, in particular with von Neumann's interactions with Stan Ulam and Niels Bohr. What if computing is not trying to model the universe through simulations? What if these computers could create their own new realities? Dyson says.
Von Neumann was also interested in biology. So he was, you know, not only using the machine for H-bomb calculations that could kill everybody, but here to explore evolution, try and create spark an evolutionary process within the memory of the machine itself. This was done by Niels Bohr, another true prophet. You know, first person to really talk about it as an artificially created universe, that what was happening in the computer was not a simulation of our universe, but it really was a new universe to itself. He had to do it, because the memory was so small, he had to do it cyclical, so these little organisms living in there were like an ant crawling around in a bottle. They didn't see the edge. And he just kept going in. Like when the bomb people got tired and went home, they let Bohr run the machine. And he ran these things usually till dawn when the engineers came back. He had a sense of humor. He knew that you know, you're not just going to create life right like that. They're just numbers, but they're essentially genotypes, and they need to have a phenotype. They have to go out and do something. And what do they need? They need to get connected to the real world, which is what happened with software. Software is simply these Bohr-type codes running in the machine that started making connections with the real world. IBM figured out how to use them for accounting. Other people figured out how to use them for bomb. We figured out how to use them for music. Flickr's figured out how to use them for pictures, and they're just reproducing like mad. And he foresaw the Ajax syndrome of codes that actually go out and spark machine processes on other machines, and how that would be sort of analogous to the distinction between proteins and nucleic acids, and how would that evolve within a computer. So this was Baricelli's last paper before he died, you know, seeing how this, where this could go. Ulam, Stan Ulam, who was von Neumann's sort of closest friend and collaborator, we don't really know, but we have this hint from a conversation on a park bench in Central Park, where Ulam is explaining, discussing with von Neumann, this idea Ulam has for sort of a cellular numerical universe, where you have actual codes that are Turing universal computation processes running free in this matrix. And that's exactly the world we live in today, where many of these just essentially software products are actually capable of universal computation. And Ulam's interest as a biologist and a mathematician was how to, you know, how this is sort of not just an analogy for life, but lifelike in itself. You can get multicellular processes running across the network or the matrix. So von Neumann died tragically. He left, you know, sort of posthumous publicly book was The Computer and the Brain, which is probably the most widely misunderstood book by people who just read the title. He's not talking about computers being like brains. The whole book is about how they're different. One of the ways they're different is that the brain uses completely different language structure, that it's not, it's completely statistical. There's no code in the brain that where the code itself has meaning. The meaning is by what connects where. And that's really what's happening on the web today, that the meaning is less and less in the code, but more and more where the links are, what the page rank is. So he talks about pulse frequency coding, which essentially is page rank. It's just page rank for neurons. And that's how the brain works and does its computations. Just because we think like mathematicians doesn't mean mathematical logic is the way brains work. You have to have a completely different statistical view of things, and more we're getting that. Julian Bigelow was von Neumann's engineer. He had worked with Norbert Wiener during the war and was hired by von Neumann. So he's the guy who made this machine, who invented the modern architecture we all use or suffer from today. A few of his ideas are still only now coming to fruition. That he was looking at this completely fresh. That you didn't have to do a computer this way. You could do it anyway. And that you know, even how you order the space and time dimensions was sort of an arbitrary choice. And that doing it serially in time is just one way, and there might be other better ways. And that the kind of computer he built for von Neumann was very inefficient in actually using all the sort of cellular capabilities of the device. And that you suffered this thing of addressing, which was sort of Gödel's curse, that every instruction has to have an exact address, and if the address is wrong, your software crashes. That's why it crashes. It goes to the wrong address and does the wrong thing. We do a tremendous amount of information processing in biology, and it's not go to this address, it's do this with the next copy of this you find that just floats through the thermodynamic soup. And more that's how these processes are working on the internet. You're saying not where this is, but what it is and what tag or template it has and what are you going to do with it. And if you write that kind of software, it's going to be extremely robust, and I think many of the companies in this room are going to be very, very successful doing that. It's the next level. It doesn't replace the von Neumann level. The von Neumann level still runs underneath all that, but it's a new, higher level that's much, much more like biology and much, much more like the way the brain works. Another insight of Bigelow's was that we're stuck on these recursive processes because computer processors eat instructions very quickly. They eat them so quickly that the only way we can generate instructions quick enough is with these recursive loops. But there's other ways of doing it. And we're seeing more and more of that. So for instance, image processing and things like that, there's ways to keep your chip running without having all that overhead of recursive instructions. And there's a tremendous new world out there for people who take advantage of that and develop more efficient processes that work the way Bigelow envisioned in the first place before sort of IBM fixed it in stone. It's the way Turing and his colleagues who again had a free horizon, they weren't restricted by any conventions, could think about the mechanization of thought processes. Irving Jack Good, who was Turing's statistical assistant, who wrote this paper on how we would get ultra-intelligent machines, and you could argue maybe we're starting to see some of those. And his central idea is that it's better to make the whole thing random. If you make a random network, it contains every network that will ever be required. You don't have to specify anything in advance. Ross Ashby, one of the old cyberneticians, his design for a brain is essentially, it's a blueprint for building Google. It's exactly what he laid out, how to put this statistical thing together. He's known for his law of requisite variety, that the control system has to be as complicated as what it controls. And my version of that is the law of unfathomable complexity, that if it's simple enough to be understandable, it's not complicated enough to be intelligent. If it's complicated enough to be intelligent, we don't understand it. But we don't have to understand an intelligent machine in order to build one.
More from this year's Emerging Technology Conference. Thanks to George Dyson, Clay Shirky, and John Udell. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Online meetings made easy. Try it free at gotomeeting.com/DTF. Thanks to all of you who have emailed in your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.